Here we go, the first question today. She's... Okay, yeah, maybe just for later on. It's okay now, but maybe later on it might get a bit stuck. As the mind gets quieter, do external sounds appear louder than they actually are? How does one block these out to help achieve samadhi? And two, is there a difference between sleepiness and dullness of the mind? Is concentration the opposite of a state of mind to dullness? So two questions here. The first, as the mind gets quieter, do external sounds appear louder than they actually are? This is actually a state of, on the way to deep samadhi, where everything is like louder, even like the itches and aches on the body. It's as if the mindfulness gets very sharp and everything is much brighter, so the itch is much itchier, and the ache is more achier, and the sounds are sort of more sharp. They're not really louder, just sharper, because as the mind dispenses with the five hindrances, it's as if the windscreen of your car is being cleaned, and so you see things with much greater detail. And so ordinary sounds which would not really disturb you, you know, appeared a bit more grating on your ear. But it's not really they appear louder, it's just that they are, you're seeing them with greater sharpness. And how one blocks these out to help achieve samadhi, it's, I've said this before and said it to quite a few people, and it comes from Ajahn Chah's very beautiful realization. It's not the sounds disturb you, but actually you disturb the sounds. What actually happens is you go out there into the world to look for something to disturb yourself. There's a little sound outside, and what is that? You hear someone talking, are they talking about me? You hear sort of a feeling in the body, is that dangerous? You know, is that a problem for me? And it's fascinating actually to see yourself going out to look for something to disturb yourself. This is just, again, a quality of restlessness of the mind. The mind isn't as happy as it really should be with what's going on. Therefore, it stays with the meditation object for a short time and then goes and looks for something to do. Just like that little dog a few minutes ago came and looked for someone to play with. And that's like the mind just goes looking for something to play with, something to disturb itself. And that function of the mind, always looking for something to disturb itself, something to occupy it, is the story of life. That's why that even though we've got nothing to do, we'll go and look for something to do. Even if you are a very smart person and you work very hard when you're young, and you buy a nice little house and you pay off the mortgage and you put a little bit of the money in the bank so you can live off the income from investment, you've got nothing to do, wouldn't that be wonderful? People who do that then either get bored stiff or they go out and look for something to do. Just like when you have your children and they're finally off your hands and you know they've left your home, they've got jobs, they've got married, what do you do then? You invite their grandchildren around to disturb yourself. You never sort of, if they haven't got grandchildren yet, you sort of keep giving them hints. When's the grandchildren going to come? Come on. And this is the thing is we're actually looking for things to disturb ourselves. And it's amazing just how people can't just sit still and do nothing and be peaceful. Even in ordinary life, we always want to distract ourselves. And this is a finer thing of what's happening in the meditation. In the meditation, so a finer aspect of this, where you're sitting there, you're just watching the breath, your stomach is full with lunch, you've got no work to do, you've got comfortable on your cushion over here, everything's nice and peaceful. And you want to disturb it. You want to look for something to, some business to do, something to occupy the mind. Basically, the doer is getting challenged because there's nothing for it to do. So it goes and makes work for itself. It makes something to do. It makes a problem out of nothing. And this is actually very often what happens when you're sitting quietly in meditation and a thought comes in or a sound comes in. It's actually you go out and fetch that sound in. You go looking for that thought. To give the doer something to do. So once you understand what the whole process is, you realize that it's a waste of time trying to get the perfectly quiet meditation place. It's a waste of time going and talking to that person who's creating all the noise and telling them to be quiet and making sure they never come to a meditation retreat ever again, especially when you're not here. Even if you have earplugs, it still doesn't work. Because earplugs can keep out external sounds, but don't keep out the internal sounds. It would be great if you could have an earplug to actually to plug the mind, a brain plug, a thought plug. But the point is that we actually go out looking for these things. Unless we know what we're doing and how to stop that, wherever we go will always be noisy and unpleasant. And after a while you learn how to stop all of that and just stay inside, and everything becomes quiet, everything becomes peaceful. And actually there might be noises outside, you just simply do not hear them. There might be aches and pains in the body, you just do not feel them. So this is actually how you overcome those distractions of the body, by learning how just to go inside, to develop that contentment in the moment. So the mind is so happy inside, it doesn't go out looking for something to do. In the same way, if you had a very nice house, and you had everything there you could ever want, why would you go outside? Why would you leave? Strange thing, isn't it, that people spend all this money on their houses and homes, and when it gets a couple of weeks holiday, they go somewhere else. They're so comfortable in their house and so nice because they spent all this money getting it just right, and the first chance they've got, they leave it. That's why in meditation, you spend all this time getting your inner house just nice, just really comfortable, just sitting here, a nice cushion, you'll be well fed, and you're just sitting, watching the breath, it's nice and comfortable, and as soon as you're comfortable, you look for something to do. You go on holiday somewhere else, look for business. So that's the nature of the mind. Know that nature. When you spot that nature, the cause of restlessness, discontent, then you know how to overcome that is develop contentment in the moment. Is that quite clear? It's a powerful and very deep question. And if knowing the answer means that one of the biggest hindrances of meditation is dealt with, and your meditation will deepen enormously. Is there a difference between sleepiness and dullness of the mind? Is concentration the opposite of a state of mind to dullness? There is a difference between sleepiness and dullness in the mind. I'm sure you've experienced it sometimes. You think you're sleepy, and you're very dull, you can't concentrate, you can't sort of watch the breath or watch anything. So you decide to go and take a nap, you lay down, you can't get to sleep. When you want to meditate, you can't meditate. When you want to sleep, you can't sleep. That's dullness of the mind. It's not physical tiredness. It's just the mind is just bored. And that boredom of the mind is leads to that dullness. It's very easy to get bored in a meditation retreat. Just watching the breath all the time. I mean, how many breaths have you watched over the last 7 or 8 days? You talk about like repeats on television. I mean, this is repeats every minute or every second. Or is it a repeat? If you really look very closely, there's no two breaths are ever the same. The point is that we just don't look that closely at the breath and don't really appreciate it so much. And after a while, you can really appreciate every breath is different. And every breath is unique. And after a while, we can appreciate the breath and we don't get bored then. Staying with boredom, we actually can put sort of some joy and happiness and fun in what we're doing. We can do that counting, which I was saying, from 1 to 9, or if you want to change it, do it from 9 to 1. Don't take shortcuts and go 2, 4, 6, 8. Some people love to do, try and make it quicker. So, I mean, just try and change things around a bit. Even little things. Because if you're getting dull in your meditation, look at the way you sit. And if you put your left leg over your right leg, do it the other way around. Put your right leg over your left leg. Just change it, even slightly, and you'll find that will change your meditation. If you always put your right hand over your left hand, move it around. Or put your hands on your knees, or fold your hands, or do something a little bit different. You'll find out that slight difference in posture, which you think is insignificant, has a psychological effect on the mind to brighten the mind and make it more interesting. Or don't just sit in here, sit outside, or sit in the room, or sit anywhere. And what that does, that gets rid of the dullness of the mind. A lot of the dullness and boredom comes from getting into a routine. Remember one of the first pieces of advice I gave you here? I don't know how many people have bothered to try it. When you brush your teeth, always brush your teeth starting at a different corner of the mouth. That actually stops you being bored. It takes actually a lot of effort, a lot of mindfulness to sort of change your routines around. So I mean, there's four corners of the mouth you can start with. So that, you know, the top left, the top right, the bottom right, the bottom left. Change it around, but don't go in rotation. Just really sort of swap it around, just whichever way you really feel like in that morning, and make that choice. Because that is developing mindfulness. We're not just going through a routine. And that mindfulness is alertness, it's interest that overcomes dullness and boredom. That's why that the so-called mindfulness of the breath, if you just allow that to be boring, there's no mindfulness there, you're just going through a routine. Every time you meditate, you sit down, this is what you do, the same thing every time. Watching the present moment, watching silence, watching the breath, watching it. And of course you go to sleep because it's nothing which is going to interest you or stimulate the mind. So make the mind stimulated. Do the breath meditation in different ways. So to start to, you know, develop like perception that the breath is what's connecting you with nature. Oh yeah, this could be my last breath. You know, this is how you die. You just take one breath out and the next breath doesn't come in anymore. So this could be your very last breath. And that keeps you awake. So whatever else it is which gets the breath interesting. As I say, you can breathe backwards. Breathing backwards is breathing out first and then breathing in. It's doing exactly the same thing, but your mindfulness is noticing it the other way around. Because we're always, strange thing is, we always, when we're looking at the breath or counting the breath, we always begin with an in-breath. So begin with an out-breath first of all, and then breathe in. Out, in, instead of in, out. I call it breathing backwards. And it just makes it a little bit more interesting for you. So that's actually how to overcome the dullness, and that's the difference between sleepiness and dullness. Sleepiness is where, you know, the body is tired, the brain is tired. And so there's actually a cause for that, a reason for that. But the dullness of the mind, you know, it's, you've slept enough already, you've eaten enough, you've had your cup of coffee, or whatever else it is, and you're still sleepy, you're still dull. And that means there's a problem there, it's just the hindrance rather than something physical. Is that okay, quite clear? Okay, the next question, as I was saying to people in the interviews, that's the reason why I learn to tell jokes when I give talks, because sometimes you're giving an hour's talk or answering questions, and you start see people's heads start to droop, and they start to nod, and that's a good time for a joke. Just to liven people up. Can you give a detailed explanation of the third precept, sexual conduct, as it applies to single people? If time permits, can you also give explanations of the other four precepts as well? The third precept is a fascinating one, this, because we've been talking recently in the monastery about this, that the five precepts, or especially the first, second and third precept is in the Eightfold Path is called Sammarkamanta. It means right action, right deeds. But also the Buddha said that the Eightfold Path should be really a celibate path if you really want to get to Nibbana, because that's the middle way. When one extreme of the middle way is Kamasukarikanu Yoga. This is Kamasukha, which is the pleasures of the five senses, which includes, you know, sexuality. Anuyoga is like, that really is the word for attachment. Indulging in the pleasures of the five senses is one of the extremes. Indulging in the pleasure of the sixth sense is the middle way. The sixth sense pleasures are the jhanas, that's allowable. And the other extreme is like harming and hurting the body. Apagilamatanu yoga. Gilamata is like tiredness and just wearing it out and getting it sort of so it's got no sort of energy, no brightness. And those are the two extremes of the middle way. So it's quite clear in that description that, say, sexuality, all sexuality, is not part of the middle way. If you want to get enlightened, you have to let that go for a while. However, the people quite rightly say, well, actually, where is that in the Eightfold Path? Because the Eightfold Path is a more detailed description of the middle way. And people look for it, obviously, in the Sammakkhamanta, right action. And there in right action you've got not killing, not stealing, which everyone understands, and you've got kamesamicchara, which is literally means not practicing wrongly with regard to the five senses. And the point is that that is also in the five precepts. It depends on which context it's in, which meaning is referred. And if as far as the five precepts are concerned, which is not sufficient to get you to Nibbana, but it's sufficient to get good karma and get to good rebirths. That's why I got the five precepts. If you want to get to Nibbana, the five precepts aren't sufficient. But so the third precept in the five precepts is not any misconduct with regard to sexuality, which is basically going to hurt and harm another person. Basically, adultery. And so really that means these, and it's one of the five precepts which I say is socially defined. It changes over the years from places to place. Because the definition in the time of the Buddha doesn't really suit the definition now. In the time of the Buddha, the standard definition of the third precept is a man cannot sleep with a lady who is either underage or is somebody else's husband or who is protected in some other way. And if you actually look at that five precepts, it means it doesn't apply to women at all. Women can do whatever she likes. She can commit adultery. She doesn't break the five precepts, according to what the Buddha said. If you look upon it literally, but of course that's not fair these days. So what we actually mean is it was just, that's the social thing of that day. These days, you would actually say that it's breaking your commitment to your partner. And even if it's in a same-sex relationship, that third precept still holds, that as long as you commit yourself to your partner and you don't sort of have sexual relationships outside of that partnership, then you're keeping the third Buddhist precept. So it's actually with the commitments there. It's interesting, there was one of the committee members of Wat Nana Chart, the monastery of Ajahn Chah's Westerners, he was one of the committee members there. He was also the headmaster of the local school. And he really put us on the spot once, because he was married, but once a week he would visit the local prostitutes. And he made no bones about this. He didn't sort of, you know, go in a raincoat sort of with glasses on. And then I remember sort of some of the monks talked to him about this and said, "You're breaking your precepts." And he said, "No, I'm not." And he's quite adamant about this and explained it to us. And I must admit, he had a point, because his wife she had some sort of illness and she became mentally deranged. And he spent the rest of his life looking after her, you know, very, very caringly. But, she was completely incapable of, you know, giving any sexuality to him. And so he said, "Look, I've got a wife, but I haven't really got a wife. And she's completely out of it all the time. And so it's as if I'm single. And so I'm not breaking my precepts at all." And actually, you had to hand it to him. Sort of, you know, he had a very good argument there. And in every other way, he was such an upright, devoted Buddhist, meditator, giving dana, etc. So that third precept of sexual conduct, you really have to judge according to the circumstances a person finds themselves in. Even in the time of the Buddha, there was prostitution there. Obviously, if it's involuntary, then of course that must be really wrong. But if it's voluntary there, I mean, there's an argument there.
I always understood that precept as meaning you needed to be in a committed relationship, which meant sleeping around is not on either.
It doesn't actually say that, and this fellow sort of actually had a very good argument there. It made me really think.
That's how it was explained to me.
Doesn't seem to be. In that particular precept. Many of the prostitutes, not many of them, but a few of them who were prostitutes actually became disciples of the Buddha and became very well respected, as many became arahats. And they said that it was a stupid thing to do simply because, not because there was anything socially wrong with it, because it was just really indulging in sensory pleasures and wasn't conducive to enlightenment at all. But you do actually read in those days that was not looked upon as being an abusive profession where sort of people would exploit the ladies.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes, in slaves and serpents. So that's where it gets exploited. That's where we're looking at some of the very worst types of prostitution in Bangkok and the Philippines and places like that, where, you know, that's certainly wrong. It's completely exploitive. And sometimes is it or not? Because, again, I've read articles by women about this, and sometimes, and if it's in some countries, they're making a choice of their profession, and you know sometimes it's harming their body. But then some people who, if they work as coal miners or even builders, they harm their body. Or if they work as footballers, you know, just they get terrible injuries exploiting their body for the sake of the pay packet.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess the question here is what is the connection between life and sexuality?
Okay, with that's just something completely different here. If it's like emotion and sexuality, it's when there is that sexuality there, the lust which comes up, there'll also, you know, be along there many other emotions which come up. You know, there's certainly like fear which comes up, the sense of excitement, jealousy is always tend to come up, there's always the possession of sense of wanting to possess and secure the object of your enjoyment. It's extremely complex and emotion. And there's also that the romance there, which is like the affection which comes up. So when we have like sexuality, there's all sorts of other emotions actually come up with it. And it becomes this enormously complex soup, which very often that it's just too complex to really to make head nor tail of, and no one really knows what they're doing until afterwards, and then they found out what they're doing, and sometimes they've just made, you know, huge mistakes which they have to pay for a long time afterwards. I know some men in Perth who had a one night stand with a lady and she became pregnant and had a child, having to pay maintenance payments, you know, which is quite a lot of money just for enormously expensive one night stand. So, you know, at the time it seemed a good idea. But you get into lust and sometimes you create all sorts of problems. So it's a very dangerous thing to play around with. The Buddha sort of described it like a flaming torch. So easy for the wind just to blow the other direction and burn you. So, you know, you have that torch because, you know, you think it's lighting the way. It has its uses, but it's extremely dangerous. So, that third precept in the terms of the five precepts, the way it's actually defined in the time of the Buddha is just adultery. Sleeping with a man, sleeping with a woman who is protected. Because she's someone else's husband or a daughter who hasn't been given away in marriage yet or underage. However, that these days it's very difficult to define, and you would really say, as a general rule, it's anything which is any sexual conduct which is really going to be hurtful. And in this particular case, you know, it would certainly be sexual conduct outside of a committed relationship. It's breaking that committed relationship, or sexual conduct with minors, or whatever. Or another thing is, which I'd also include in here, is sexual conduct between teachers and students, which is well known in schools to be not on. And that should also be with lay Buddhist teachers and their students as well, because that teacher-student relationship, you know, should not be turned into sexual exploitation. Make sense? Any comments on this?
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously in the time of the Buddha, that definition is very much based on women as being property or
that's right, yeah.
Men, so that prostitution, I guess, was seen as something that combined or something, and that was allowable. But it's interesting to see how that definition is going to change and who's responsible for giving it more of a context space.
Well, it's interesting actually that in the time of the Buddha, it wasn't, prostitution was looked upon as being very different than it is these days. So much so that, when the first translators translated these, they called them courtesans, because they were actually highly regarded in the community. It wasn't considered to be a low profession, but a profession of independence for the woman, where she didn't really have to be beholden to a husband or to be a father, where she would have servants and would be reasonably wealthy. That's one of the prostitutes, Amber Pali, who was so wealthy that she actually gave her mango grove to the Buddha outside of Waisali, and it became one of his favourite monasteries. So, I mean, these weren't regarded as being a low-class profession at that particular time. So it was actually interesting, the different social mores at the time. I'm not judging it either way, and it's very hard. This is why it's very hard to judge something for 2,500 years ago. But it certainly was ways which people would behave in those days. You read this here, like in the Vinaya, and also in the books of the Therigata, where many of these women became arahats and actually explained some of their lifestyle before. And obviously at that time when they decided to become courtesans, actually they were very proud of their profession.
Well,
I think it's also I'm going way beyond sort of like Dhamma meditation here. This is just like amongst ideas, and I'm not quite sure if I should be considered an authority on such matters. But I'll answer any question, and usually put my foot in it most of the time. But I think it's more like just the customs, the opportunities there. Which is, I'm not quite sure what's happening these days, but I understand there are male prostitutes around, and they're not just for other males, they're for females as well. And you know, if the possibilities are there and the money's there, and it's also considered to be an okay thing to do, then some people would make use of that. But really, that's such a complex question. But there wasn't male prostitutes in the time of the Buddha that I know of, reading in the suttas, but there were female prostitutes, and they were high-class people in society. It wasn't looked down upon as being a rotten job, but as being quite a high job. Why that was, and who knows? No, they weren't, no. There were free agents who had the right to accept or refuse people. Some of them were single and some of them were married. There was, I remember one story, which is an important one, for another reason, where there was a man wanted to go to a prostitute, one of the courtesans, and she didn't know him. And so she said, well, I don't know you, I'm not going to go with you. She exercised her choice. And the man said, oh, look, I'm a disciple of one of these monks. He will vouch for me. And so he went to see this monk and said, will you go to her and vouch for me? And I'm okay. And this monk went and said, no, he's okay. And because of that, the Buddha laid down a rule. That's not what a monk should be doing. Well, there's always that if a rule is not laid down, eventually a monk will do it. And then you have to lay down a rule because of it.
If you see someone playing the fire, can you go over and help them play the fire?
Yeah.
Like this melting pot.
Yeah.
Sexuality.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's karmically bad, yes. It's karmically bad. But even, and this is actually challenging, it's even like karmically unwholesome to even have sexual relationship with your committed partner. Not many monks have got the guts to say that. It's because it is increasing craving, increasing attachment. It's karmically unwholesome in the sense that it will lead to more rebirth. If it's with your partner in, you know, good realms, if it if it's karmically, really karmically unwholesome, it's going to lead to lower realms. But it's still going to lead to rebirth. The Buddha actually defined, if anything which is acted on by greed, hate and delusion is karmically unwholesome. But not many monks have got the guts to say that. Because, you know, we don't want to upset sort of everybody. People aren't going to come and give us, bring us down after a while if he keeps talking about this. Okay, when it gets to tantric, it's very, I'm very happy you didn't call it tantric Buddhism, because that's like an oxymoron again. It's, there's always a tendency with human beings is either to have their cake and eat it, and to sort of, you know, try and sort of twist the teachings around so that you can do whatever you want and get enlightened at the same time. And this is what they were doing with so-called, you know, tantric practices. Thinking that you can somehow, you know, have sexuality and justify it as being, you know, on the path to enlightenment. But if you look at original Buddhism, the way the Buddha taught, there's no possibility, no even crack in the teachings which will allow that. And anybody who has done even a tiny bit of meditation just knows how sticky that whole thing is. As soon as there's any sexuality, you know, that's, you know, you're lost in attachments and cravings. I remember some person coming up to the Ajahn Chah once and said, from the United States, of course, and they were saying that, yeah, oh, well, you know, I'm sexually active, but I'm not attached. And Ajahn Chah rolled his eyes and said, look, that can't be the case. That's another case when he said, it's like saying, you know, you eat salt, but it's not salty. If it's an obligation, then that's a very difficult one there, because it's... like a person joining the army, it's an obligation to fight. So, you know, if you've got the opportunity, don't make the obligation in the future. Next lifetime, be a nun, be a monk.
Also, Prabhu said that in Thailand, having forest monasteries and teachers like Ajahn Chah, that there are places like Bangkok and that Prabhu Buddhism and the Dharma all over the world.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, the forest monks in Thailand are not all that respected.
Internationally, Thailand and Bangkok is known for prostitution.
Absolutely.
And not for the Dhamma.
Absolutely. Like Sri Lanka, similar, is known in the Tamil war there. Why is that happening in sort of Buddhist countries? And somebody actually pointed out once that whenever this is very, very good teaching, it seems to be whenever there's the very highest, there's always the very lowest next door to it. It seems to be just the nature of the of life, why that's so, who knows. But certainly the forest monks in Thailand who are teaching the Dhamma, they're not all that respected. Because they ask people to keep the five precepts. And people don't like that. I don't know if a lot of them are mentioned here, about a couple of years ago, no more than that, 5 years ago in Thailand, I was told that when, this was just one of the habits, when people go into the temples to keep the five precepts, you know, which was, you know, part of the culture, they had to go up there and, you know, take the five precepts, the pansil, but they didn't want to lie. They had no intention of keeping the five precepts. So when they wanted to drink alcohol, they would do this. And they still chant all the five precepts, but they'd be just keeping four precepts. And sometimes they have two fingers down, sometimes all the fingers are down. But they were still doing the chanting, so it looked to everyone else as if, you know, they were sort of, you know, good Buddhists. But they weren't. And so when the forest monks go along and say these things, sometimes people get very upset. Because most people, they want their Buddhism to be nice and soft, you know, we'll give you nice alms, you know, we'll go out sort of drinking and partying the night before, and then we'll sort of make merit with you afterwards to even things out a bit. And that's actually popular Buddhism, unfortunately, and it's also in the Western world as well. I mean, how many Buddhists in, even in Melbourne, I mean, Tibetan Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhists, will go down to the pub, you know, after sort of hearing the talk, and thinking there's sort of, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Do they have the precepts?
They have the precepts. The what's in basic Theravada Buddhism is basic to all Buddhist teachings. They'd have it there, but whether they'd notice it and encourage it is another matter. Because the basic Buddhist teachings, those texts, were also taken from India to Tibet and to China. They were translated, they're there, but they're not talked about very much. And that's why, that, you know, there's not many monks who are willing to talk about such things. Even in Perth, you know, you sort of start to say, well, you know, you shouldn't sort of take alcohol. And straight away, you know, a few people, well, you know, just one glass, that doesn't matter, does it? It's just social drinking. I mean, so I've got no choice, you know, you have to go business and things like that. And, you know, this is how you've got to sometimes be quite sort of firm and say, look, you know, five precepts means five precepts, even a little bit of alcohol is wrong. But then you give them a hand. And one of the disciples over there got this very beautiful skillful means on how to avoid taking alcohol when you go to functions as a businessman. Because before he would say, I can't drink alcohol, I'm a Buddhist. And they'd say, you know, don't be stupid, don't be religious, you know, you're like a nut, drink alcohol. And that, it would never work. So he changed his tack and said that I can't drink doctor's orders. When he said that, no one would sort of press alcohol on him. Doctor's orders. And so, you know, they would say, I have an orange juice instead. And, you know, when he first told me, he said, isn't that lying? He said, no, it's not lying. He reminded me, in the suttas, in the Tripitaka, the Buddha described himself as a doctor many times. So it's Dr. Buddha's orders. Which is true. And the Buddha described it similarly of a doctor. So, you know, he was going there and sort of saying, I can't drink, doctor, Buddha's orders. That's very skillful means. So if you're going to tell people this, you've got to help them keep the precepts by giving them skillful means.
Well, just in a sentence, what's the major difference between Mahayana and Theravada?
In a sense,
you've already mentioned the Bodhisattva.
That's actually probably the biggest. I started the Bodhisattva idea. And also, philosophically, the Sunyata idea becomes like far too philosophical. But this is on the surface of things. When it gets to the heart of the matter, not just what people believe, but what they practice, then there's no difference at all. Because even in the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva precepts are the six paramitas, which include sila, samadhi, and panya. as well as, I think, was it Dana, Karuna, and Virya or something. So, if you're a bodhisattva, or you're practicing that path, you have to practice sila. You have to keep your precepts. You have to stop drinking and messing around. You have to samadhi. You have to develop jhanas. That's sama samadhi. You have to develop wisdom. So if a person really was practicing, you know, what you're supposed to practice in Mahayana, they'd be doing exactly the same thing, the Eightfold Path, which is sila, samadhi, panya. So when it gets down to actually what you're supposed to do, it all comes together in the same. Why you're supposed to do it, or the theory behind it, is sometimes different. So that's a nice thing, actually. If a person is a Mahayana, they're practicing, they're a good monk or a good nun in the Mahayana tradition, and then I go and see them, and you can be very friendly towards them because they're the same as you, they're doing the same as you. Maybe wearing different robes, having different theories, but they're practicing the same. So it's all going to lead to the same thing. Okay, next question. Dana offerings. If one does the cooking, preparing, and the other one does the offering, who gets the merit? And the answer is the one who does the eating. I get the benefit of the good taste of the food. No. Everyone gets the merit. Even someone who's passing by and thinks, oh, that's very nice. Even they get the merit as well. Because they're rejoicing in the act. And just rejoicing in the act is also getting the merit. So even if you can't afford to bring the dana, but you go along and you know, you just help out and just support them, what a wonderful thing that is. That's also enormous merit. And also the one who does the eating does get the merit, because he's also encouraging dana as well. Yeah. It's the amount of effort. The harder it is, the more merit it is. That's why rich people who offer dana, you know, it might not be too much sacrifice for them to give, you know, $50. But if it's like a poor person, that's really a lot of money, that's enormous merit. And I remember that, because when I was a student, I got inspired once by this Tibetan nun who gave this talk. I decided to, you know, on the spur of the moment, to give £10 to her. She had an orphanage somewhere in Kalimpong or somewhere around there, Sikkim. And that was, this was 1968-69, that was 2 weeks dinner money for me, food money. And so I really suffered because of that. You know, physically I got enough to eat, but not as much as I normally would. And I had to do a bit of fasting. But that gave me so much happiness. That was actually a hard £10 to give. But it was marvellous. And I really sort of, you know, I enjoyed that so much. And it was the best £10 I ever spent. It was worth going hungry for. And that's why it's like a lot of merit. Once in our monastery in Thailand, you saw this young girl who was like mentally retarded. And you know, she was, it's a very interesting story, because she would only grunt. And this, you know, even though I understood Thai and Laotian in the area, I could never understand what she meant, but the friends who'd grown up with her in the village understood her perfectly. It's as if they had a different language, you know, from anything anyone had ever heard. The different way she grunted, the late girls who'd grown up with her knew exactly what she wanted. It was fascinating to see her around. Communicating with the friends she grew up with. But anyway, that one day I was cleaning up our hall, and I was just around the corner behind a cupboard, and I saw this little girl creep in. And I just wondered what she was up to. I never let her see me, but she was looking around to make sure that no one was there. And she crept up to the altar, and she put this little paper flower which she'd made on the altar. And then she crept out, you know, she bowed very quickly and crept out. And it was not a very beautiful flower. You know, it was the best she could do. But when I saw actually how hard it was for her to put that flower on there, you know, because of her physical condition, and what she'd actually done, she was so embarrassed. that she actually had to creep in there when no one was looking, but I saw her. And afterwards I told all the other monks, anyone who touches that flower has got me to do it, that's going to stay there for a long time. I was just so moved and impressed by that. And that sort of, the dana she got from that was enormous, because it was so hard for her to do that. So that's what we really mean by dana. It's the harder it is to do. Even that, I mean, it's a very good question. If you give, sort of, you know, just for the sake of giving, is that more merit or less merit than giving with the intention of getting good karma afterwards? It's very hard to say which is more and which is less, because a person who's wise knows that giving will create merit. It's just understanding, if I give something, then it's going to be good karma as a result. So you love to give. Now, I love to try and give as much as I can of myself to teach or to help others. I know that's a lot of happiness there. It's very confusing. Am I doing this actually giving for giving's sake or to get happiness back? It's very difficult to understand exactly which is the... I think it's a combination of both. So, you know, why are you eating? You know, you eat because it's going to make you healthy and make you fit and happy. That's why you should make merit. Food for the heart. Food for the mind. So even if you know that it's going to give you a lot of merit and you want lots of merit, then go for it. Don't stop and think this is greed. That's not greed for worldly things, that's greed for unworldly things. Especially if you want to do this for enlightenment.
And that kind of desire is okay?
That desire is okay, yes. The cravings which are not okay, the cravings which lead to suffering are karma dhanha. The craving for sensuality, bhava dhanha, the craving for existence, the vibhava dhanha, which is the very strange craving of a self wanting to destroy the self. So that's not included there. The craving for enlightenment, the craving for non-sensual happiness is not conducive to suffering. The desire to make merit is not part of the Second Noble Truth. So go for it. In terms of desire to keep precepts. In fact, it's a wise person who knows if they make merit, if they give dana, they're going to be happy. If they keep precepts, they're going to be free from a lot of suffering. If they meditate, they're going to get closer to nibbana. Especially the reason why you should be doing things is like the same as when a person becomes a monk, we do this chant in our ordination, Sabba Dukkha Nisarana Nibbana Satikarana Taya, for the sake of ending all suffering and for the realization of Nibbana. And that's actually part of the ordination chanting. And I always remind the young novices and young monks, always remember that chant, always remember why you became a monk and nun, for the ending of all suffering, for the realization of Nibbana. And keep that in your mind all the time. And really, that's why you should be giving dana. For the realization of nibbana, for the ending of all suffering. That's why you should be keeping precepts. For the realization of nibbana, for the ending of all suffering. And if you do it with that intention, that's the purest, most noblest of intentions. Is that okay? Okay. Could you please explain the correct way to serve drink to monks after 12 noon, especially fresh squeezed orange juice? How many times should it be strained? Thank you. Okay, here we get into the complexities of the monks' rules. When it gets to fruit juices, because those juices in the tropics, if they were kept too long, would ferment and get alcoholic, and you don't want to see monks or not suffering from alcohol. And sometimes it has happened. Some of my friends in Western monks, they got some wine gums from Canada, and they thought that wine gums, there wasn't any wine in it, it was just a name. And so they shared them out with each other, and there was real wine in it. And they got tipsy, these monks. Because, you know, after you haven't had alcohol for so many years, you get extremely sensitive. It wasn't a great amount of alcohol, but they were tipsy. And they had to be much more careful next time to make sure that wine gums actually didn't have wine. Or, you know, chocolate doesn't have rum in it. Or apparently someone almost got some rum chocolate for me this trip. Or like you have some of these cakes that sometimes got alcohol in it. So you've got to be very careful when you give these things to monks, because even though it's a small amount, and probably you wouldn't not even notice it, for monks they're so sensitive, and nuns, that a little bit can make them tipsy.
That's like cold tablets. A lot of cold tablets and farmer's tablets have serotonin in it, which is sort of a byproduct of speed and amphetamine. And it makes me really quite speedy.
It's interesting that actually the drugs, which is part of the fifth precept, not alcohol and drugs, they're like the stupefying drugs. What they call narcotics, which cause narcosis, which is like sleepiness. But anything which is going to really affect the mind that much, you should maybe keep clear of. Well, sometimes you've just got to take the advice of a doctor. And sometimes they do knock you out. And they do lessen your mindfulness. But sometimes that's necessary to cure the disease. You know, that if I'm having an operation, sometimes they give anaesthetic, and that certainly stops mindfulness. But, you know, it probably might be a good idea. And as far as, like, the filtering the juices, the point is that to make sure it's orange juice and not an orange, I mean, if you just put, like, an orange in the blender and then just serve the whole lot to a monk, that's just like taking an orange, isn't it? So the idea, you should filter it so it's like orange juice rather than orange. And some of the commentaries go to extreme lengths in saying it should be filtered 7 times, but you don't need to go to that degree. As long as if you look at it and there's no flesh visible in there, then it's okay. Or even if it's a tiny bit of flesh, but it's not sort of, obviously it has been filtered and most of the flesh has been taken out, it's okay. So that's the same with apple juice and other juices, just to make sure that it's been reasonably well filtered.
Chocolate, okay.
Is it? Basically, because it tastes nice. I say that because it's, again, this is Ajahn Jaka, my predecessor, once said very wisely, it is not a clear rule stating it's absolutely clearly prohibited, then it's allowed. No, he wasn't a lawyer, but he understood human nature. And so, you know, if it's not prohibited, it means it's allowed. And because it wasn't absolutely prohibited anywhere, and you can... basically, yes. And it's sort of, therefore it's allowable. So, a lot of these things, that's why just because it's allowable doesn't mean you have to eat it. And that's sometimes that... it's sometimes lay people's fault because you feel usually actually it's just because people eat in the afternoon, and if I'm ever I'm visiting anybody in the afternoon and they want to have their meal, they feel so guilty they want to get some chocolate to give to you so they can eat their meal and not feel guilty about it. So the point is that you don't need to sort of offer these things unless it's really necessary for the monk. So you know, I've got heaps of chocolate left in my room because people keep giving me more and more and more. And you know, I try and give it away to other people because it's too much. So you don't need to give these things. Basically, if there's a reason behind it. If, for example, like a monk has been doing some physical work, you know, mixing concrete and stuff like that, or for some reason they missed their meal because they had to go and see someone in a hospital or something, then it's a good idea to sort of give some of those things. A lot of the time, my problem is actually getting too much. And you know, trying to say no, and eating too much, and drinking too much, and having too much chocolate, because, you know, I don't want to disappoint too many people. So I said this some time ago, that my stomach doesn't belong to me anymore. It belongs to you. So please look after it, to make sure it lasts a long time. Yeah? Monks are not vegetarian, no. When I was a young monk, I had to eat frogs. That's right, yes. Because you had to eat whatever you were given. We prefer vegetarian. It's not bad to offer anything to a monk or a nun. If your intention is pure, it's much better to offer vegetarian food, if that's possible for you. That's a problem, yeah.
And is that bad? Are we doing that as a service?
Actually, it would be nice to look to see what is good for the monk and what the monk can eat. I mentioned this earlier on in the retreat that a tradition in Thailand is whatever you give a monk to eat, that's what you'll get when you get to heaven. So if you like to eat dal in heaven, you have to give monks lots of dal. Even if the monks don't like dal. And so some Thai people, they like this particular type of food, and they don't care whether the monk likes it or not, because they like it, and that's what they want to eat after they die and they get to heaven. So this is the problem with many people. They want to give what they like to eat, or they want to give, you know, what they think the monk likes. And basically, I was actually quite surprised, even my mother, when I first went home to England. You know, she thought, well, how am I going to get you rice and curry? I said, look, just because I'm a monk doesn't mean I like rice and curry. And I said, look, can't you remember? It said made in England. And it's still, again, like people sort of give you the food which they think monks like, not realizing that monks from different countries, different places. And so there was a sutta which I mentioned this morning called The Cook. And that's actually about satipatthana, mindfulness. So you see what the monk takes and see what he eats. And that's the way you can find out what to give. Because the monk will never tell you. A good monk will never actually ask for anything. Okay, next question. Could you kindly explain getting the right PIN number in detail? This is the PIN number. It's a simile which I give for good karma and bad karma. Each one of you has got lots and lots and lots and lots of good karma, so why isn't it producing lots and lots and lots of happiness? We've got lots of bad karma as well, and very easily we can sort of access that and get lots of unhappiness. So the thing is that we can actually, there is a way of accessing the good karma we have in the past. And this is actually part of some of the meditations which the Buddha suggested. We've got things like Chaganusati, one of the 40 meditations, 40 gamatanas of the Buddha. And that's something which I encourage you to practice as a way of meditation. What that means is you reflect, you remember, you dwell on all of your generosity, all the times you've given donations or given food to monks. Of course, if you've never done that, you can't dwell on it at all, but you assume that everyone here has done lots of those sorts of things. And you dwell upon it, like I dwelt on the time I gave £10 to that Tibetan nun. And every time I dwell on that and remember what I did, how wonderful it was, it gives me happiness and joy, and it uplifts my mind. It turns it in the right direction. And then afterwards, and I can start meditating. And you meditate starting with happiness. And it's easy to get deep meditation then. Or, these days, because I don't give monetary donations to anybody, because I haven't got money, but you give a lot of your time to others. So if this evening I want to sort of sit meditation when I go back to my room and sort of get rid of my tiredness, I think, what have I done today? And how much good karma I've made today by teaching others and by being a good example of a monk. And as soon as I start reflecting on my own chaga, my own liberality and generosity, it brings up happiness. And that happiness leads to the beautiful meditations. That's what I mean by the PIN number. You reflect and bring up memories of all of your goodness and kindness. In the Western world, we're not supposed to do that. And it's one of the most stupid parts of our culture. Whenever we do anything bad, we're really supposed to linger on it and think about it and be guilty as hell about it. whenever we do anything good, we're supposed to forget it as soon as possible. And it's supposed to be, it should be the other way around. Whenever we do anything bad, forget that quickly. Forgive it. But if we do anything good, keep on thinking about it, linger on it. Don't even get it out of your mind. And that way you find a much happier people. That's the pin number, Chaganusati. The reflection on your liberality. Even Siranusati, reflection on your precepts. You've been keeping all these beautiful precepts. Now this last week, earlier on, even for years, some of you. Think about that, that's beautiful. Once you start to reflect upon that, it gives so much happiness. And from that happiness, you can start to meditate on the breath. It's just so easy when you think just how pure you've lived the last few days, how pure you've lived so many months, so many years. So all of those of you who have done dharmas and generosity, have known great monks and great nuns, who kept precepts and done many retreats, reflect upon that until tears come to your eyes. What a wonderful thing you're doing. And then you start watching the breath, and it's just so easy because your mind is filled with bliss. There was one of the stories I like telling is of Visakha, the chief female lay disciple of the Buddha. She once asked the Buddha whether she could give what's called rainy season bathing cloths to the monks. Because what happened one day that she was about to make a dana for the monks, and so she sent one of her servants to the monastery to tell the monks it was time to come. But as it happened, there was a big rainstorm, and the Buddha advised the monks actually to bathe in the rain. And so the monks were bathing in the rain, the servant went in there, and she saw all these naked monks. And so she went back and said, there's no monks there, there's only Jains, naked ascetics. And Visakha knew there was something wrong, and she said, go back again. And so she went back, and by this time the monks were sort of dressed up, and so she invited them to the house. And as a result of that, the Visakha said, look, sort of, I know you're monks, you don't really care, but you know, for some people, seeing naked monks is, you know, is not nice. So she said, can I offer little cloths for the monk's waist whenever it rains? And while I'm at it, can I offer bathing cloths to the nuns? And while I'm at it, that sometimes in this city, there's monks come for the first time, they don't know where to get alms on alms round. Can they come to my house the first day they arrive in Sarvati? Can I offer them food in my house? So the very first day, at least, they know where to come for something to eat. And also the last day before they go out travelling, because and then they need something special, you know, a pair of sandals or something, and I can offer it to them. And also that, you know, sometimes the monks are sick, and they need special food when they're sick. So, you know, I'm rich and I'm very devoted. May I offer food to any monks or nuns who are sick? And when you're sick, you need people nursing, and sometimes nursing is a 24-hour job. And sometimes those monks who are nursing, other sick monks, nuns nursing sick nuns, won't have time to get their own food. Can I send food to them as well? Can I do that, please? She asked the Buddha. And the Buddha said, I can't just let you do it alone. I mean, everyone should have a chance to do this. And then Visakha showed her wisdom. She said to the Buddha, if you allow me to do this, then I'll know that any monk or nun who becomes enlightened, or gets any stage of enlightenment in this monastery, in the Jeta Grove, I know that I'd at least serve them dana once when they first arrived. And probably many times if they were looking after the sick or the sick themselves. And when I reflect that I've helped them gain these wonderful states of jhana or stream winning, once returning, non returning, arahat, when I think of that, said my mind will have pity, will have joy. He said, when my mind has pity, it will become tranquil, will have prasadi. And from tranquility, happiness, sukha will arise in my mind. And from sukha, my mind will become concentrated, will get into samadhi states. Because of that samadhi, I will see things as they truly are. And because I see things as they truly are, I will attain nibbana myself. And when the Lord Buddha heard her tell this wonderful sequence, which I've been mentioning to you, during this retreat, in such an eloquent way, and realize how well she understood the Dhamma, she said, "I'll give you that permission." And so she had special permission above all other people in that city to give these things, and only her. And I remember that story, and I tell people, actually, if they come and give alms at our monastery, especially like a Katina time or the start of the rain retreat, I say that any monk or nun in this monastery who gets a jhana during this rain retreat becomes a stream winner, once eternal, non-eternal, arahat, you've helped them. Because of that, think about that. That's just enormous merit. That should give you pity, joy, from which you'll get the tranquility of the body and mind, from which you'll get the sukha, the happiness, from which you too will get samadhi. And you'll see things as they truly are with insight, and you'll become enlightened as well. And it shows the causal sequence of the path to enlightenment by knowing the pin number. Visakha knew the pin number. That's why the Buddha understood her request and let her do that. So when you do give dana, always remember what you're doing. Remember it time and time and time again. And then you know the pin number and you get happiness at any moment. Whenever I think of all that I've done for the Sangha, for the Sasana, it's immense. And even now, just talking about this, and start getting piti coming up and eyes getting watery. Wow, that's really a huge karma. Immense, wonderful. Now it's easy to sort of, if I had to handle all these questions, I usually get into samadhi. Do you understand the pin number now? Each one of you has got heaps of good karma there. You know, many of you have been visited arahats. Imagine that, and given food to such beings. Just remember that, and wow, you really start getting some energy coming up in you. When what?
When, what was that?
Many of you.
Have visited arahats?
Yes, right, yes. Not all of you, but some of you. You never know.
Right now.
You never know. Okay, I won't follow that sort of line. Today practicing metta was good, even towards my estranged husband. He was a fairly restrained and civil split. Wishing him well was relatively easy. At the stage of forgiveness, offering to him and asking for myself, the feelings that arose at the heart center were too strong and I lost concentration. I was eventually able to establish concentration on the breath and noted consciousness, and consciousness is conditioned with some fear and aversion to return to this practice. What do we do when strong feelings arise due to the object of concentration? And more generally, what role do you think counseling and psychotherapy offer after dealing with difficult or entrenched feelings? Okay, the person here was doing loving kindness and was going okay with their estranged husband until trying to offer and give for oneself forgiveness. Again, because people who are very physically close to you do arouse very strong emotions, it's just a case of like two pieces of wood, the closer they are, the more friction there is between them. Because of that, it's good to have at least such beings towards the end of one's loving kindness meditation. Because the fire in this particular case wasn't strong enough, the fire of loving kindness. So actually when you did take hold of yourself and the husband and try to give loving kindness towards them, the metta wasn't strong enough to really overcome some of those emotions. If you'd practiced some more loving kindness towards other beings and really got it very strong, then you find actually that not only could you wish him well relatively easy, but you could also even give each other forgiveness. When loving kindness is that strong, it's so easy to do. So the fire was a bit too weak that it didn't really catch the wet, sappy logs. And that's why you lost concentration. The next time, leave it till later. When you have strong feelings of peace and strong feelings of loving kindness, again, it's much easier to forgive. One of the ways you can forgive another person is to realize they deserve forgiveness. The only way you can forgive yourself if you can understand that you deserve forgiveness. And how do we understand we deserve forgiveness? And why is it hard and sometimes we think we don't deserve forgiveness? The old simile of the brick wall. When you only see the two bad bricks, that wall does not deserve forgiveness. What they did to me, or the stupid thing I did. And that's all it is, because just as in anger and ill will, you just see the two bad bricks. With the inability to give forgiveness, you just see the rotten things which that person did, or the stupid things you did. And you do need that extra mindfulness to look on either side of the faults, to see the good bricks. And once in that person you can see the good bricks in their wall, then you can forgive them, because they are appropriate for forgiveness. You can forgive them when you can see something more than their faults. And also you can forgive yourself when you realize that your faults is not just the only part of you. There's lots of wonderful, beautiful things in there as well. So it's important to understand that simile of the brick wall, and to understand the reason why we can't forgive very easily is because we focus on the hurt and not the beautiful things and the beautiful times we've had together. Once that mindfulness and that wisdom do widen the perspective and see much more of what's going on, forgiveness becomes extremely easy. Forgiveness means you allow that wall to be, you don't want to destroy it anymore. And you're at peace with that wall. It's not a problem anymore, you don't need to fix it up. Problem solved. So many of these strong feelings, hatred, ill will, and guilt, lack of forgiveness, it arises because of an obsession with only seeing half the story. Not even half, just a fraction of the story. And it's because of perception. Perception becomes conditioned by hatred and ill will. So we only see that which keeps on justifying our perceptions. The same old sequence of view, perception and thought of the Whipalasas. And we need to expand that so we can see something more. And once perception gets through mindfulness, is able to stretch its boundaries, then we can actually start to perceive the object of our anger and ill will, whether it's somebody else or ourselves, in a completely wider light, and realize that we're not so bad. One of the strange things about the husband you hate so much or the wife you hate so much is other people can actually love them and think they're a wonderful person. That's really quite strange for people after divorce, their husband goes and gets married. And it really sort of upsets the wife. I mean, what can he see? Or what can she see in him? And she can see quite a lot. Because the wife, who's just divorced her husband, can see only the faults and the stupidity in the man. But the point is there, is in any man or any woman, as a human being, they've got the beautiful bits in the wall, and they've also got the mistakes in the wall as well. And if we can see the good parts of the wall as well as the mistakes, then we can forgive. Because they're worth forgiving. And I can forgive myself because I am worth forgiving. I've done lots of good things as well. Make sense? So use that brick wall simile. Yeah? That's right, yeah. Think of the good things you do. And that means that you don't get angry. And you can forgive them. Think of the bad things they've done. And you sort of, you get upset. Okay. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah, well, just the best thing to do is for those sorts of things is just to, when you go to monasteries, go and look. Well, the thing is that our monastery, we've got plenty of things over there, but if you actually, the monastery over here, or the monasteries over here, go and look what the monk needs. Or sometimes just ask the monk, Venerable Sir, is there anything you need? And that's it. Sometimes it's much better than doing that than just keep on offering robes and after robes after robes. Because, you know, this robe over here lasts a couple of years at least. But, you know, sometimes you get given another robe every week, in 2 weeks. So what we have to do, what we actually usually do is send them to poor countries. But sometimes if people realise, I mean, you don't need too many robes. We haven't got wardrobes like you have. With a different robe, what robe should I wear today? It's the same old robe. So mindfulness and alertness is actually seeing what the monks want, or rather what they need. And some of the Westerners in our monastery, I'm really impressed with them. They're very, very sharp, and they look. And they see if you need a new batteries for your flashlight. Because they see me walking back, and just the flashlight beam is very dark, dim. So the next day, they come up and say, here's some batteries for you. I'm really impressed, because they're really looking out, and they're watching. And just the last thing is, and more generally, what role do you think counselling and psychotherapists offer when dealing with difficult or entrenched feelings? It's much cheaper to come to a monk than go to a psychotherapist or a counsellor. Unfortunately, I know that some people might get upset at me for this, but wow, I've got all these questions here. The counselling, heaps of them yet, I've only started. Counselling has become a fashion now, and some of the trauma counselling which people have, sometimes I was a bit sort of very doubtful about whether it's very useful. And recently I was reading in the Guardian Weekly, which we get a weekly newspaper in our monastery in Perth, and that Guardian Weekly was saying that a recent survey of people who were involved in the Paddington railway crash over a year and a half ago, that those people who received counselling compared with those people who didn't receive counselling, the people who didn't receive counselling are far better off. They're much happier. And it was actually sometimes actually wondering actually what this counselling is actually doing. I think sometimes in a Buddhist perspective, it's sometimes in this particular case, is actually reinforcing, you know, some of those images in your mind and telling you you have to bring it up, you have to deal with it. And that's actually making people more traumatized. Rather than a Buddhist perspective is let it go. Acknowledge, forgive, and don't deal with it anymore. Just abandon it. And you can do that very quickly. You don't have to keep on bringing it up again and again and again and again and again. Some other people tell me that. Do I have to bring up all my past to be free of the past? And I said, if you bring up all the past, it's endless. And also that your memories of the past are sometimes bent and are not accurate. Even a week ago, sometimes what you think happened is not really what happened. Even a few minutes ago, policemen who investigate accidents, you know, try and get the witness statements as soon as possible. But they all know a witness statement, even 5 minutes after the accident, people who've seen the same accident will give different descriptions of what happened. Already, after 5 minutes, the memory has been warped, let alone memories of your childhood or memories of what happened in that big accident. So counselling has to be done very, very sensitively, if at all. And the best counsellor is yourself, using mindfulness to understand what's going on and have the guts to forgive and let go and be free of it. The best therapy is what you're doing now. Meditation. In extreme cases, you can see that counselling and therapy does have a role to play. If someone really can't shake their traumas. But most people have the ability to do it themselves and do it very well. Does a person observing a lay life, sila namely, ajiva Astamika, in other words, keeping the eight precepts, and not the eight precepts, Astamika, have to omit the night meal daily. I'm not quite sure, how was this? To avoid the confusion of my way of explaining, this ajiva Astamika sila, I should say, consists of the five precepts, Okay, and Pisuna Vacha, Parusa Vacha, and Sampapalapa. And Mitra Ajiva. That's 9 precepts. Okay, this particular practice is keeping the 5 precepts plus not using malicious speech, and not harsh speech, and not sort of idle gossip, and not a wrong mode of livelihood. So I never actually heard of someone actually determining those precepts before, but if you want to keep them, they're fine. It's the hardest one there will be the idle gossip, because that's part of our culture. You need to gossip and talk about things. What I mean idle gossip, it means just talking about all sorts of things. And Pisuna Vacha means malicious gossip. And Parusa Vacha means harsh words, calling someone an idiot or a fool. So if you're keeping those precepts, that's fine. You don't need to omit the night meal. You can have something in the evening. I was thinking that was the 8 precepts. I'm going to go quickly through these. So a wise woman would not send metta to a monk. Why not? I don't know why that is. Unless there's something else to this. Still got... they're all mixed up now. So, I'll leave that one until I can find the other half to it. And come down. Is it okay to call on heavenly gods for help when in times of distress and need? Not as a replacement of Dhamma, but supplementing the Dhamma. Yeah, it's okay to do so. But remember, like anything else, if you haven't got the karma, if you can't afford the fare, you can't get in the taxi. So the gods can only help you, in a sense, if you've got the karma to get that help. But people ask the gods too much for help. There's this, I know it's a different story, but it's a similar story, that once this person, I think he went to see the Buddha because his father had died, and all his life his father hadn't gone to the temple, and sort of hadn't kept precepts, and he wanted the Buddha to chant for his father so that he would go to heaven. I don't know if it was actually the Buddha or another monk. I think it could have been another monk. And so this other monk said, well, okay, but as part of the service, you've got to take these two jars. What's the Buddha? Take the two jars to the river. That's right, what's the Buddha? Take the two jars to the river and break the jars over the river. And then come back and tell me what happened. And one jar had ghee in, the other one had rocks. And so he broke the jars over the river, and of course the ghee, being oily, floated on the surface and the rocks went down. And then the man went back and told what had happened, and the Buddha said, now go and chant all these gathas, and when the ghee drops down to the bottom, and when the rocks float to the surface, then come and tell me. I think you get the message there. you can chant till you're dead, and still those rocks won't come to the surface, because it's their karma to sink. And sort of it's a karma for the ghee to float. So sometimes all the chanting in the world won't help at all, if your karma is not sort of sufficient. So get a point there? Can you please suggest a way of getting rid of the fear for household insects and spiders, etc.? Actually, just watch the spiders. Sort of just investigate them. And just like the spiders, like anybody else, are really afraid of you, much more than you are of them. And they just like live their lives in your house. And if you really want to, you can just catch them very, very gently. You know, just even like put a glass on top of them, a piece of paper or card underneath, and take them outside if you wish to. If you don't like them in there, but be very gentle to them. But they don't do any harm to your house. Some of those house spiders are very handy because they sort of help clean things up. So if you actually watch nature, watch insects and watch spiders, you'll have much more respect for them. And with the respect for them, there'll be more loving kindness and less fear. So just observe and watch.
So would it be okay counterbalancing for someone to buy a cat to get rid of mice, or
No, it wouldn't be a good idea at all, because that's again getting someone else to do the dirty work for you. Except that sometimes, like, they say that a cat smell would deter mice. But I'm not sure if that's true or not. Well, they don't. Usually, like, animals, like even snakes, they don't bite anybody unless they're attacked. And you've got more chance of getting bit by sort of doing something with them than if you just leave them alone. That's a nice question. That wins the prize for today. Praise gets you everywhere. So it's good to pray things. It's good. Praise yourself. If you had a good meditation, praise yourself. Have an extra cup of coffee or tea or whatever else you like. Take yourself down to the beach, have a nice afternoon, because when you praise yourself for success, you tend to repeat success. I find that my meditation is often relevant to the kind of vibrations in the meditation place. Some venues have given me lots of energy. Is this all in the mind or just a case of blaming the tools? Thank you. Now I find that as well. There's some places you go to straight away, it's very easy to meditate. In some places are very difficult. I know that in Thailand they used to say that if there's lots of devas around, it's very easy to meditate there. And there is places which are easy, places which are hard. Even in the sutras they say that as well. So, but you can make those vibrations. So because of our monastery in Thailand, monastery in Perth, monks have been meditating in that meditation hall for so many years now, and they've had some really great meditation experiences in there. It's a powerful place to meditate. And many people sort of have great meditations there. But you actually build up the vibrations.
Do other people apart from monks stay at that monastery?
Yeah.
Like that you have lay
courses? No, not courses, but people could actually come and visit temporarily. They also influence as well. If you've got some really good meditators in the hall, they help everyone else along. They create atmosphere. In the same way, if someone is really, really angry, comes into this room, everyone feels it. If someone comes in and got heaps and heaps of loving kindness, everyone softens. So we do affect each other that way. I'm not going to be able to finish all of these because it's almost 9:30. I'll just go for another couple. When practicing loving kindness to all beings, do you have to adjust the quantities of metta to different peoples at different situations? Say, like when someone is really angry with you, you send extra metta to him. That's very nice. I thought you were going to say less. But to someone, especially of opposite sex, getting overly friendly, you send less or complete none to him. That's a really good question. I suppose actually the quality of the matter should be the same to all beings, but maybe like the time that you sort of...